We will turn to the book of 1 Chronicles in chapter 11. 1 Chronicles in chapter 11. Now, to give you a timeline of Chronicles, or what we're doing here, Abraham, when he was on earth, was somewhere around 2000 to 2200 B.C. In other words, a thousand years before the time of David. David, at this time here, from what we understand, just the period of David's first reign, or his first part of his reign, and that is covered in the next several chapters of 1 Chronicles. It goes from 1003 B.C. to 995 B.C., about 8 years. So there's a lot of material that's put into David's first 8 years. And then we know that after David came Solomon. The temple was built somewhere around 950 B.C. or before Christ, the year before Christ. Then you get into, of course, we know that the temple was destroyed in 586 B.C. with Nebuchadnezzar. And then we know that Ezra and Nehemiah, their genre, Zerubbabel, they came along about 500 B.C. to about 450 B.C., and Malachi winds up about 400 B.C. That's all, they overlap each other quite a bit. And so here we see that if Ezra wrote this, or whoever wrote this, we know that it was 1 Chronicles, was post-exilic. Now, that's a big fancy word for people who aren't used to the words like that. But post-exile, in other words, after the exile. David was pre-exile, you know, and of course David wouldn't have known anything about the exile because it never hit him, or Solomon, or any of the rest. So 1 and 2 Kings doesn't mention anything about the exile other than, of course, what happened at the very end and how they were taken off into captivity. We see that Ezra then is writing, and if he's writing about David now, he is writing about 600-year-old history. So that puts you in the time frame of the nation. Now, in saying that, you know, we like to go back and how sad it is that our people don't know anything, and that's one of the things that gets us in trouble with politics and everything else. There's a concerted effort for our people to be ignorant of history. In fact, one of the sad things that we're seeing is New York Times has been promoting this silly historian who's been debunked and everything else about how the United States really got started, the New World really got started, not with the Pilgrims and Jamestown and all that, but in 1619 when the first slaves came over, and the United States was built on slavery and all this. And of course, all it is to make people think that our whole country was built on evil. And I was reading a historian recently. Oh, it's so good to read people like Helen Brinker, Brown or Owen. I forget. She was a Pulitzer Prize winner back in the 70s, back in the bicentennial. And she had written The Miracle of Philadelphia. And back then, I mean, to win a Pulitzer Prize, you know, it had to be good. And she was a very good historian, loved the book. And even though she didn't mention a lot about the Lord, she realized that it was a miracle for those divergent bunch of people to get together and to make a nation. I mean, it was just a miracle that we have this miracle document called the Constitution. Conversely, you have people today that are writing and saying all you had was a bunch of evil slave owners trying to get learning, and then a bunch of capitalists from the north, and they were trying to get together to figure out how to mess the whole world up. That's basically what it is. And so we see that, and that's what's being taught in schools today. And, you know, how sad that is. You know, we had a president said this is not an exceptional country, exceptionalism and all that. And Donna Shalala, who was, she's used to be, I think, either with one of the universities, either Miami or USC, but she was, in the cabinet of Bill Clinton. That's a very influential lady. And again, she's one of those who don't believe in American exceptionalism. And she's been president of universities and everything else. So you see how that our universities even, our state schools, and the University of Illinois is one of the prime targets, do not teach our history. And the good and bad, that's one thing I like about the Bible, is it puts all of it out there. And, I mean, you have the good and the bad. Now, I don't mind a historian telling me about some of the things that people did wrong. For instance, we know that I know a few things about George Washington. For one thing, he was a slave owner. Another thing, he loved to dance and, you know, all this kind of stuff. He married into money and all you get all those things. Well, but yet, was he not a great man? You know, I mean, he had a lot of flaws. And I mentioned a few days ago or a week ago or whatever about Thomas Jefferson. He was, in many ways, a lousy man. But God used him. He was a brilliant man. And in spite of his flaws, God used him. And we see that in with what Dominic likes to bring up again is about David. David was a very honorable. He was a man after God's own heart, but he was one of the most wicked men in the Bible. I mean, some of the things he did, there's no explanation. There's no reason. There's no way to defend him on some of the things he did. And so that's the bad thing about, that's the good and the bad about history, is that the men, the best of men have been men at best. And you could either go back and the country apart and say, look, and trash it, or you say that God used these people in spite of who they were. And I would much rather go back and say God's hand was upon this nation. God shed his grace on us in spite of who we were. Yes, they love to talk about Wounded Knee, where the Indians were slaughtered up in North Dakota. And yes, those were horrible things. But does that mean that everybody in the United States were Indian slaughterers? So you see all the problems. And by the way, you know, I like Sherman and Sheridan and some of those great Civil War generals were the very ones who went out west and massacred the Indians. So, you know, they're heroes and they're villains at the same time. So, yes, we can go back and we could just cut this country apart without even talking about any good things about it. Or we can say, go back and say, God used these people, men and women, even though they were evil, God meant it for good in what he did through them. And so we see that David, it's interesting because, again, the Chronicles are going to be concentrating on Judah. They're going to be concentrating on the spirituality of Judah. They're going to be talking about the kings and the light of the priests and what the prophets did with the people of Judah. And the central theme is not the throne, but the temple. Because Ezra, after all, was a priest. And so you'll see that temple very prominent all the way through, including David. So he skips over after all the nine chapters of the begets or the chronologies that he brings out. And by the way, what they're doing is trying to connect the old with the new, the old people and where they had their land. This land was mine. God gave this land to me. You remember it was divided among the tribes by Joshua. And the one thing that Israel had that made it it was not an absolute monarch, was a monarchy, was the fact that there was private land ownership. Time and time again, you'll say that the Bible will say that even after a defeat, that the children of Israel, every man went back to his own tent. In other words, he went back to his own home that he owned. And even whenever northern Israel split off and those diabolical kings like Ahab came along and he stole the land, remember? And what happened to him? He stole the land from a good old farmer. And what happened? God cursed him because that land was the man. What was the farmer's name? I'm drawing a blank now. Nabob's vineyard, right. And so there again, God cursed them because God gave that land to Nabob, and it was in his family. And that's why the Chronicles are so important, because Ezra's going back and reestablishing who owned what and where they were and their lands and everything else, what cities they were from. and then saying this is where they are today. Now, of course, there's gaps in that because for 1,000 years of history, you would have a book. I mean, it would be bigger than this Bible, you know. But he's giving you a genealogy or a line that can be traced far enough where these people would know they own their land. Now, in saying that, that made David a different monarch, because as a king, he didn't own everything. When you own everything, then you could tell everybody what to do. What I mean by that is, we could have freedom of the press, but if the government owns the press, guess what gets printed? The things the government wants to be printed. So you see how that goes. If the government owns your home, do you really own a home? No, you don't own it. They give you permission to own your home. And that's it. And so we see that the whole concept of private enterprise and the idea of private ownership is one of the keys to freedom. And so we see that the nation of Israel was more of a federalist type of, like a nation of states like we have. And we'll see, especially, it's drawn out in chapters 11 and 12, when David was able to unite these people together. Unfortunately, it only lasted about, how long? For David, for about 40 years, and then Solomon, another 40. About 80 years was about the whole unified, because it was such a precarious state. I mean, and it wasn't long before there was a civil war and a split of the states and all that. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? But again, we see that how that God brought this together. Now, in saying that, the Ezra or the whoever, and we'll just call it Ezra. You can dispute who wrote the First Kings, but for the sake of simplicity, I'm going to say Ezra. Now, someone might want to say the writer of Chronicles. That's too hard to say. I'm just going to say Ezra. You know, just one word. But if Ezra wrote this, then he just gives lip service to Saul. And, of course, we know 1 Samuel gives almost a whole book to Saul. And so Saul was nothing, because Saul didn't deal. I mean, he was, of course, a king that was not God's original plan. And so we see that God, he talks about it. But then in chapter 11, we see how he says, then all Israel came to David at Hebron. Okay, now's the united monarchy. And notice how that he is talking about the nation of Israel. And he's just discounting anything before it. He says, indeed, and they came to Hebron saying, we are we are your bone and your flesh also. In time past, even when Saul was king, you were the one that led Israel out and brought them in. So notice how that, again, Ezra starts off the idea that, yes, David was God's man. And we realize that. He says, you shall shepherd my people Israel and be ruler over my people Israel. Therefore, all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel according to the word of the Lord by Samuel. So here we go back, 600 years of history that he writes in or 600 years before that he writes in just one paragraph. And David and all Israel went to Jerusalem, which is Jebus. Now, this is where we kind of fill in. You have to go back to 2 Samuel to get some of the story, but then the rest of it is filled in by Chronicles. He says he went to Jebus. It's Jebusalem, not Jerusalem. It was the Jebusites who owned, and it was a fortress. It was considered impregnable. Nobody could get it. In fact, the Jebusites, they did something wrong. You don't challenge a guy like David, because when you challenge him, he's going to say, I'll do it or die. You know, so, and they said, you're not going to take us, because even our weaklings and the crippled people and children could protect this place, because it was a formidable place. And it would be very difficult to scale the walls, or it was built up on a mountain. and steep cliffs all around and just very few ways to get in, and they would be easily protected. And so they thought they were pretty secure. And yet we know that that was God's city. And that was where back 1,000 years before David, we had Abraham who was offering his son Isaac right there on that mount. And so we see that God had a plan for Jebusalem or Jerusalem. And by the way, Jebus was the people. Salem, the king of peace. Remember Melchizedek? All that was all wrapped up in that area there. But so it was a combination of names. But we notice about the inhabitants of Jebus said to David, "You should not come here." And nevertheless, David took the stronghold. That is the city of David. Now, we know then that the city of David originally was the center or the most strong point of Jerusalem. And from that time, and especially in the time of Solomon, they built all that was around it. So you had the city of David, which was kind of the impregnable fortress. And then you had the temple and all the rest that was built later on all around that area. And it was garrisoned. I mean, you had streets. So you had all kinds of things that were put in after David was there. It says, and so we see that David dwelt in the stronghold in verse 7. Therefore, they called it the city of David, and he built there around it from the city of from Milo to the surrounding area. And Job repaired the rest of the city. So David went on and became great, and the Lord of hosts was with him. Now notice it says Joab, was the one who helped him build the city. Now, if you go back to 2 Samuel, you'll see that David told whoever can take this city, and of course we know there's only, and we see a flaw, we've been looking at it, there's a way to get under those city walls if anybody could go under the springs and come up in the water chute that feeds the city, then they could open the gates and let us in. And guess who was the man who did it? Joab. Joab had had his ups and downs with David. He was David's cousin. And they had had their ups and downs all during, even before Hebron. And yet we see that God promised, or that David promised. And so Joab became his strongman. Joab is one of those interesting men in Scripture also, because he was extremely gifted, both as a general and as a warrior and as an organizer. But you don't cross him. He was one of those guys who just didn't kill you as a look at you. He was a cold-blooded murderer. And so we see that Joab was one of those mixed blessings, if you want to call that. But we see that God used him in spite of who he was. And so David went and went on and became great, and the Lord of hosts was with him. Now, the Lord of hosts was with David even though he had evil men around him. So government is never perfect. It's amazing what God can do even through evil men, or men that are half good, half bad, if that's the case. You know, whatever. So we see that even from the beginning. But then we notice now these were the heads of the mighty men. Now these were the men that really were the power behind the throne. And it's amazing how they came together and how they were able to then work outward and to unite a whole nation from the southernmost parts to the very northern tribes. And these people came together, and they're a federal society or a federal way of doing things. And notice it says, and these were the heads of David's mighty men who were strengthened themselves with him in this kingdom with all Israel to make him king according to the word of the Lord concerning Israel. So notice this was God's doing. And this is the number of the mighty men which David had. Joabim, the son of the Hakamite, chief of the captains. Now, without going too deep into it, but those who have studied all this and put it all together tell us that David had 12 corps in his army. In other words, 12 corps, if you read the C-O-R-P-S. But he had 12 organizations, or 12 armies within the army, or divisions, we would call them, or corps. And so within that, then we know that Joab was the head, but many of the 12 of these mighty men, there's 37 Second Samuel tells us the beginning. There were 37 before David took over Jerusalem and added to them. But of those, we know that 12 of them were corps commanders. And there again, that's a study that how long do you want to be here? How technical you want to get. But there again, so we see that David, these mighty men, many of them were the scouring of the earth that came to David when he was running from Saul. And David trained them. And he inculcated what he was, his vision, his spirituality, his desire for what Israel had. And so they saw him and they gave their lives to him. And they trusted him totally. And so we see that, notice what he did. He lifted up his spear and against 300 and killed, 300 killed by him at one time. Now that's an army. And that's one guy. Now it's kind of like the person at the bridge. What was the name of the, Judy? You guys read that. What was the name of the Roman Empire where he stood at the bridge and killed? You don't remember the guy? Okay. Anyway, there's several situations where Rome, and then of course you had the 300 Spartans that stood against a million Persians and things like that. So it is possible, given the right place at the right time, where somebody could hold off an army for quite a while. But this guy must have been quite a battler, because he killed 300 in one battle. And after him was Eliezer, the son of Dodo, an Ohite. Now these, when you see an Ohite or whatever, these were cities that were within Jerusalem or in Israel. It says, who was of the three mighty men? He was with David at Pastamim. Now there were the Philistines who gathered in battle, and there was a piece of ground. And again, you go back and you read that, and it doesn't tell us what the battle was in 2 Samuel. It tells us what the battle is here in 2 Chronicles. And this is the fella who stood in the middle of the battlefield and just killed all the Philistines and got so tired that he couldn't even, his hand clave to the sword. In other words, he couldn't even take his hand off the sword. He had fought so long. You ever done that, anything like that? I remember when our first child was small, and Judy was in some conference, and the lady was speaking, and we were the host church and so forth, and there were a lot of people from different churches, and a pastor had come that I hadn't seen in years, and we sat back and we talked for quite a while the ladies were carrying on, and I was holding Jonathan in my arm. And I didn't realize how long I held that kid in my arm, because I could not unbend my arm for about 3 days. You ever do that as a mother or as where you've held some kid? Well, you can imagine what it would be like to fight so long for your life, as well as killing a lot of people, and to the point that you can't even let loose the sword. What a tenacious fighter this guy is. And again, okay, that would be, that was, we're going to begin in verse 14. And they stationed themselves in the middle of that field and defended it and killed the Philistines. And so the Lord brought a great victory. And now three of the 30 men went down to the rock of David, the cave of Adullam. So it tells us again that these men were David's mighty men, and they were becoming mighty men during his exile from Saul. And they were in the cave of Adullam. And David learned something about leadership there, because he saw the hot, dusty fields, and his men were up there with him, and they were all tired and dusty, and he said, "Oh, if I could just have a water from the cave that's right outside of my hometown of Bethlehem," which was down the mountain. And these three guys went right in the middle of all the Philistines and got him a drink of water and brought it up to him. I've learned as a pastor not to tell people what I want, because people almost feel like they, you know, I mean, if it's something, I told you about the one time I told everybody I love banana pudding. Well, I had seven banana puddings at the next covered dish dinner we had, you know. So I'm careful to not tell everybody what I like, except that Lamborghini. If boy, I'd drill it. No, but you know. But as a pastor, I don't want to use my people. I don't want them to make like feel like, oh man, poor old pastor, we got to do this for him, because there's a lot of people that, you know, that will sacrifice for things that you never really intended them to sacrifice for you. And these men risked their lives to go get him a drink of water. Is that loyalty or is that loyalty? And they brought it to him. And David, being the man he was, he said, oh, my guys, you shouldn't have done this. And he poured it out before the Lord and he praised the Lord for him. And so there again, we see that these men were willing to give. Not only were they tenacious fighters, but they were extremely loyal, willing to give their lives. And yet they were men that had their own foibles. They could be broken. Because if you remember at Ziklag later on, that whenever they had lost everything and they had gone off to fight and they came back to Ziklag and the Amalekites had come in and stolen all the children and wives and everything. And these men who had left everything there in Ziklag lost everything. And it says that his own men thought about stoning him. You know, so it doesn't mean that I'm not sure about these three guys, but there were these mighty men had the same problems we have. But here we see that they were willing, and David inspired great leadership. And so they broke through the camp, and we see that happen. Now, notice in verse 20, Abishai. Now, he's the second born of the Joab family, and he was the brother of Joab, was the chief of another three. And he lifted up his spear against 300 men and killed them and won a name among these three. So he was another brave man. Also, Abishai, if you remember, is the fellow who David, who said he would go with David when David went right in the middle of the camp of Saul and stole Saul's water pitcher and came back out and said, oh, Saul, remember that? Well, Abishai was willing to go and face death with him. So, again, we see that these men were extremely loyal, and he was one of the other three. Therefore, he became a captain, a corps commander. However, he did not attain to the first three. And so we see this in Scripture, even with the Lord. Remember the Lord's disciples? Did he have an inner circle? He had his Peter, James, and John, didn't he? And then he also had the 12, and then he had the 70. You know, there were people around him that were willing to follow him. And yet he trained people to train others. And so here we see that David tripled his situation by training the first three. And now you've got another three on the outer band of the first three. And so it spokes out. And so we see that David is weaving a fantastic leadership here with his men. And so we see of the three, he was more honored than the other two men. And it goes on. And then Benaiah, this was another. He was a valiant man in verse 22. And he was one of those second three. And he did many things and killed a lion and all these other things. Then he also took on a giant from Egypt that had a spear like a weaver's beam. We see in verse 23. Now, those old looms or weaver beams, I mean, these things would be huge, 8 feet across, and they could weigh well over 100 pounds. Now, in battle, they're very cumbersome, but if a man knows and he's strong enough to use it, he could wipe out a whole lot of people just by swinging it, let alone stabbing them with it. And so in battle, you'd want that guy to be around because he could clear out a whole path in front of you, but you wouldn't be close enough that he would hit you, of course. But then again, if you are fast enough, you can whip him. And that's exactly what happened here, because not only did Benaiah take the spear away from him, but he killed him with his own spear. Now, that's kind of like David and Goliath, isn't it? So again, we see these guys were tenacious in battle, and they loved David. And then notice also in verse 26, also mighty warriors of Asahel, the son of Joah. And he mentions a lot of people. And he mentions from almost every tribe. But then what the phenomenal thing about it is that we see in this, we see other people that were proselytes. In other words, people who had given their hearts to the Lord or had whatever, we see that they became part of Israel. And to become part of Israel, and especially part of the army, you had to be, you know, right down the line as a proselyte, you had to be baptized into Israel to be a proselyte. But notice some of the odd people. Notice in verse 39, Zelek, the Ammonite. Now, if anybody hated Israel, it was the Ammonites. And yet we see that there were those who came to know the Lord and became part of David's army. It kind of shows you what God can do even with his enemies. And so we see that in verse 41, Uriah the Hittite. And of course, the Hittites were, you date them back to the time of Abraham. And they were the people that pretty much came before the Phoenicians. And they all kind of amalgamated together and made the state of, or the country of Phoenicia later on. And then we have others that that are there. In fact, notice in verse 46, that the very last person named is Ithma the Moabite. Again, we see that God would accept anybody who would accept him. You remember there was another famous Moabite that God greatly blessed. And what was her name? Ruth. Right? So here we see that actually the message of God and, of course, of Israel was that whosoever will come may come. And we see that people from all around these enemy tribes accepted the God of Israel and were willing to fight with David. And so, again, we see a very interesting amalgamation of people that were there. And then in chapter 12, you see it kind of spreads out farther. Now, it says, now there were the men who came to David at Ziklag. Remember, that was one of his last battles before he became king in Hebron and stayed in Hebron for 7 years before he finally was able to get the whole thing together. And notice many of these, they came from Saul. And they were mighty men and they were helpers in the war, armed with bows. And so God sent him people from all over. Notice in chapter 12, verse 3, at the last part of that, it says, Barakah and Jehu, the Ephraimite, and Ishmael, the Gibeonite. Now, who were the Gibeonites? Remember, the Gibeonites were the town that whenever Joshua invaded Israel, they tried to make a pact with him, and they fooled Joshua, and they were there, and they were still there, and they now are becoming, you know, part of Israel, even though they were not Israelites. And so that tells you a lot about how that God can bring a nation together and with different ethnic groups and different tribes, and how that when his blessing is upon it, how that can work and how there's peace. And yet, you can also see in history just how easy it is to fall apart. And so whenever we talk about a United States, is it united in name only? Because we know there are people today that are desperately trying to destroy the unity of this country. Again, we see in verse 8, and some of the Gadites, now, of course, they were on the east side of the Jordan. They joined David at a stronghold in the wilderness. Mighty men of valor, men trained for battle. So that tells us that each one of these tribes had armies or militia or whatever you want to call it, and they trained them themselves. And so these were state armies. And so they were trained for battle and could handle a shield and a spear whose names were like the faces of lions. And so these were tenacious fighters, he's saying. And he goes on and names several others that were involved in this. And then we see that finally, whenever the children or whenever Saul was on his, after he had been killed, Amasai, in verse 18, he was the chief of the captains of Saul, and they were willing to unite. He says, We are yours, O David. We are on your side, O son of Jesse. Peace, peace to you, and peace to your helpers, for your God helps you. So notice they were willing to give their allegiance and to unite the kingdom together. And so God is the one who has to work in the hearts of men to do that. And we go on and we see that there were almost every tribe is named here. And the sons of Judah and that are named, and Ephraim. And notice even some of the most obscure tribes, verse 32, of the sons of Issachar. And it tells us that Issachar, who's ever heard of Issachar? And yet he was one of the minor tribes. And yet they were men who had understanding of the times. Now, what does that mean, other than the fact that God had gifted them with something that could greatly help David and to know what Israel ought to do? So God was working in their hearts. And so we see in their chiefs were 200, and it talks about how they came. And Zebulun, verse 33, they were 50,000 who went out to battle, expert in war. There again, they had trained their own army with all the weapons and so forth. And Naphtali in verse 34, and the Danites in verse 35, and Asher in verse 36. And notice it says, these who could go out to war, were able to keep battle formation. Now, that tells us that we're well trained. It's one thing to have an army full of fighters. It's another thing, and anybody's been in the service, so endless drill. They just teach you how to march up and down and all that. They want to make it second nature to you, especially if you're in infantry, because they want to have it so that whenever they give a command, you've got 1,000 men who will do something all at one time. And it's very important that you are able to do that in a battle. And it should be second nature. And so here these men have been well drilled, and they were ready. It's one thing to do it on the parade ground. It's another thing to do it in a war when you got things being shot at you and everything else. So here we see. Okay, how do you feed? Okay, there again, it talks about those who are able to keep rank. And then okay, if you want to find that out, notice it says at the last part in verse 40, Zebulun and Naphtali were bringing food and donkeys and camels and mules and oxen and provisions and flour and cakes and figs. And so they were the breadbasket of the army. So, yeah, that's being a military man, that's the first thing you ask. And God has provision. Isn't it interesting how that God provides? And each one of these tribes had something that contributed to the whole. And so it is in a church. You know, when I think of one thing I've learned as a pastor is I can't do everything. And I must pray that God will surround me with people that can do the work of the ministry. And not only do the work of the ministry and do it well, but also learn how to get along with one another and work together for the common good of all. In a day of narcissism, that is a very difficult thing to do. Whenever you have people, every man is doing what is right in his own eyes. And so we see that this was very important. And so we see that God brought this nation together under a king that everyone loved. It was one of those phenomenal things in history where really you have kind of a democratic, benevolent king, because he didn't own everything. He had to really have the armies and all these different tribes work with him. And yet he was a master politician knowing how to do it, because notice in chapter 13, and David consulted with the captains of thousands and hundreds and every leader. David went to the choir director. He went to all these different people, and David realized that he couldn't say, okay, I'm the king, this is the way it's going to be. No, he learned how to bring these people together and help them to, of course, all under the common goal of doing what God says. Because notice Ezra recognizes that, because we look back at verse 22 of chapter 12, and it says, from that time, they came to David day by day to help him until it was a great army like the army of God. So here we see that Ezra recognized God did this, not David. And he looks back on 600 years of history, and he doesn't see all the problems that all these people had. And he said, well, it was just a mistake that got, that came together, and it worked for a while. No, he said, God's hand was upon that. My country, it is of thee, Lord. There's no reason we should be a country from sea to shining sea and all that. We're so diverse. We've got so many problems. I mean, we're so spread out. But you realize we're the biggest, largest country in the world that has one language? I mean, from Seattle to Miami, from Maine to California, you can go any place in this country. And if you can't speak to someone, you could find somebody very quickly that you can. Why? Because God saw that a guy named Webster, back in the 1820s, decided he was going to make an American dictionary. And so he got all the words together, and even though we have archaic words and we still use them, and they're spelt like a beauty, beauty is spelt half French and half whatever, B-E-A-U-T-Y, I mean, all that stuff, but yet we know what it is. And one of the most difficult things, okay, shoot my kid. He knows not to come. No, but I don't know why my kids call it this time. But they're on a different time zone. But at the same time, but God has blessed. And the one thing that will destroy a country is different languages. And that's the one thing Israel had was Hebrew. From Dan to Beersheba, everybody spoke the same language. And so these were the different things that happened. Notice again, those who want to destroy our country, you don't realize that if you go to a hospital in California, they have to have 40 different people with different languages because there are that many people that they say have a right to medic, and they don't have to speak English. I mean, it's crazy. And so people are intentionally trying to destroy our country through culture and everything else. It's amazing how that God did this, and he brought this nation together. But it is the Lord who raises up one and he casts down another. And isn't that what the Lord told Moses? And what Moses told the people was that when you follow me, there's life and there's health. But also there's blessings. But there are also cursing. And he said, these are the curses that are going to happen to you. And he named them. And he said, finally, what I'm going to do is spread you all over the world. And that's exactly what happened. So we see that God's hand was upon David. Was he perfect? No. As you look at this, you can even go back to Uriah the Hittite. One of the major problems, when you think about David, there were several things that he did. He nearly split his nation. But Uriah was a Hittite, but he was a mighty man of valor. He was one of the heroes of the day. Very well-known, popular guy who married a beautiful girl that was part of the inner circle, the counselors of Israel. And David had him killed. Remember? One of his mighty men, the man who tried, didn't even want to have relations with his wife because his men out on the battlefield. I mean, I tell you, folks, that's above and beyond the call of duty. And yet, David had him killed. Do you realize what that did to the rest of the mighty men? You realize that sowed the seed for about and how that caused the problem. And that's why so many of those people were willing to take off later on after Solomon and were willing to split the nation up. I mean, just the things that were there. And then, of course, you have other. But you see these interpersonal relationships that matter. And so it is in our life. You know, God is not mocked. What we sow, we reap. And sometimes it's reaped generations later. But we see a nation that was brought together by God, not by David. We see the ebb and flow of history and how that God protected and used David and brought in the people that they needed. God says that he gives good gifts to the church. Well, Lord, I'm praying for gifts to the church. You know, I want him to give us more gifted people. We've got gifted people here. But Lord, expand our borders, as we saw last week with Jabez. Lord, expand our influence upon others. But you'll have to give us people of influence who have the ability to influence others and yet have the loyalty and the love and the compassion for us all to work together. That's what God does. Nations and churches and any organization are built or they are hung together by a God who allows them to be together. I look at some of the evil country. I have no idea. I mean, you look at Nazi Germany. I look at how scraggly old corporal, failed man, how that he could rise up and unite a whole country and take on the whole world. And the systematic ways that they worked in villages and from France to Russia and the influence they had and how that was all. I mean, he was an organizational genius. Now, I'm not saying that he was a good genius. There are evil geniuses. But how can God use a man like that? And so we see that God can do that in our nation. God can raise up men that don't really know him, but yet he can use them. Or he can raise up people that will destroy us. And so it is. We see that our hand, that God raises up one and casts down another. So as we pray for our country, boy, we're in a mess today. And we see people trying to destroy it. One thing that we do have, but the one thing that if it happens, we won't have any more freedom, is the right of private property. As long as you can own your car, as long as you can own your whatever, your house or whatever, you have some semblance of freedom. But we have people in our country today. In fact, in 1988, long time ago, Michael Dukakis's chief campaign strategist, she was a woman, and she went to one of the Ivy League schools, and her theme 32 years ago of her doctrinal thesis was the evils of private ownership in America. That was 32 years ago. Can you see what's happening today with the whole idea of the evil of capitalism, the evil of ownership and all that? And we should let the government do everything. So we see that these things come and flow, come and go. And folks, I don't know how to stop it other than saying, God, you've got to turn hearts. You've got to raise up men and women who know how to stand for you. You've got to raise up people, even who may not know you, but yet at the same time, they love this country. So you see how that everything depends on God. And even here, we see that David was a man after God's own heart. But God had to put around David men that were after David's own heart. And how that God brings people together to make a nation. Or he allows them to devolve and destroy a nation. But oh, that God would bless us. Oh, that we want to pray for our country. That God would raise up righteous men and women. And the courts in our cities, in our town. We want to pray for our mayor. It matters all the difference in the world, the people they listen to and the people that counsel them and the freedoms that we have, and that God can bless us again. Let's take our hymnals.